All right, here we go.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN, which is a media project of SWAP East, and SWAP is a sex worker outreach project. Tonight our special guest is author Andrea Dean Van Skoyak, and she is an award-winning author of Horror Synesteria, which I hope I'm pronouncing better than I think I am. Am I pronouncing that right, Andrea?
You did fine, Gracie.
Because that's a made-up genre now, isn't it?
Well, yes, from what I understand, I mean, everyone thinks I made it up, but I didn't. I wish I was that creative that I could take credit for that. But that is what the other authors that I'm friends with and what my readers, that is what they all deemed what I write, because it's not really horror like Jason and Freddy and, like, I don't know, Hostel and House of a Thousand Corpses and things like that. So they said, that's horror. What you write is more sinister and twisted in nature. So it's more like horror sinisteria. And I'm like, well, yeah, okay. And then before you know it, everyone's like, oh, tell us about this genre that you invented. I'm like, no, I did not invent the genre. Everyone else invented it for me and stuck me in it. So I wish I could claim credit for it, but to this day, I can't do it. My conscience will not allow me to claim credit for something I didn't do.
Well, at some point, horror had to be a new genre. Someone had to coin that, too. So
that's true. That's true.
It all has to start somewhere.
I don't mind them sticking me in it. I will just continue to protest my innocence. I did not invent it. I wish I was that creative.
So the difference would be, now, I know that a few of the books, because you know that I am also part of Ephemera Bound. I do some editing for different imprints than what you were in. So I know a little bit about some of the books that you have with Ephemera Bound, Michael and The Two Worlds, and I forget the other one.
The Two and a Man of Two Worlds, uh-huh.
Yeah. I put them together, The Two Men of Worlds.
That's okay.
And now I know
when I go to cons, they say, now, are these two separate novels, or is this a book and a sequel? I'm like, no, they're standalone.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I know in your work is that they are kind of what, in my growing up, my distinction between like a horror and like suspense, that you're, the sinisteria is sort of that suspenseful sort of thing, but that you are using more of a paranormal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Than you know, your standard spy novel kind of thing.
Right, right. And like I said, people, when you say horror, they think of House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects and things like that. And my novels don't fall anywhere near into that category.
So tell us about, and I believe there also you are, you're not writing erotica, but that you do not step away from the, you know, fundamental basics of sexuality with your characters.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I do have a collection of erotica that has been picked up by Triad Publishing, and I used to write erotica as a hobby all the time. So, no, I have absolutely no problems writing erotica. Most of, I'd say 99.99% of my erotica is guy-on-guy, which bothers some people. But that's where my mature readers come in handy who say, no, I can read that and read the story for what it is, and it doesn't bother me, which I'm always grateful for that. But I have no problems with putting erotica in my work if it's necessary. Now, I can't stand gratuitous anything. So you will never see sex for sex's sake or violence for violence's sake in my work. I absolutely cannot stand that.
So how do you, you know, we have a joke when I write a sex kit and then we're dealing with authors there. One of the things we always talk about is, you know, there's only so many ways to write about sex because it's tab A and slot B, no matter who or what is doing it. And the other thing is to, you know, it's one of the harder things to write erotica is because, you know, how do you make, you know, like the old actress saying, you know, I'll only do it if it's integral to the plot.
Right.
You know, when do you decide that sex is integral to a plot? That when is that not gratuitous? When is that necessary?
Well, like in Michael, I'll give you a prime example and hope that I'm not giving too much away. Michael is a being that has never had a body. He's just been a spirit, just inhabiting a cemetery for as far back as he can remember. And he finally gets a body. He inhabits the body of a newly buried young man. And when he gets out, he's got a body and he's got these feelings and he doesn't understand what he does from right or wrong. And he doesn't think of sexuality as in, oh, well, okay, I'm a guy, so I should be with a woman. No, he decides that he loves a man, which is Taylor. And so I have a few sex scenes between them, and I also have like a rape scene in there, but it's all integral to the story. He's in love with Taylor, so those are in there for that reason. And then the rape scene is because he picks up a hooker, and he doesn't know anything bad about that. You know, he doesn't know that you're not supposed to pick up hookers. And that's when it's integral to my stories. I've read stories where someone's walking down the street, and they get picked up by some guy, and then they start having sex in their car. And it's like, okay, and that has what to do with the fact that she's walking down the street, and her car's broken down, and she's trying to get somewhere? I mean, I guess if you wanted to stretch it, you could say, oh, okay, well, I guess she's paying the guy for the ride, and she's getting a little bit more of a ride than what maybe she anticipated. But I like to think that the sex in my stories adds something, just like in the two. The two brothers in that are rapists. And even though that's not erotica and it's not sex per se, it's brutal rape, but it's part of the story, and it has to be in there.
So I'm going to have to back you up a bit because this is Sex Worker Radio Network here. When you say that Michael doesn't know that picking up a hooker is bad, can you elaborate that? I don't mean you on the defensive, but we here believe that sex work should be a legal, legitimate industry. So wouldn't think that is bad. But can you elaborate what that is from the character point of view?
Until they change the laws, picking up hookers is illegal. And
right.
He's never had a body, so he doesn't know that. When this woman steps out of the shadows and she's like, oh, hey, how you doing? He's like, oh, hi, how are you? He doesn't know that, okay, well, what if there's cops around? Then he's going to get arrested and he's going to have his picture plastered all over the internet or whatever. He doesn't know. No, he doesn't know because...
You said that was a rape scene with that?
Well, she rapes him more or less because he doesn't want her. He wants Taylor.
Ah, okay.
So
clear as mud until we read the book all the way through, right?
I'm sorry?
I said that's going to remain a bit clear as mud until we read the book all the way through.
Oh, yeah, once you read the book, it'll be completely clear. But, yeah, that's the only reason why I said picking up a hooker is wrong, because even though I personally have no problem with people doing whatever they want to do as long as they don't hurt me and they don't bother me and they don't interfere with my life or bring anything home to me like sexual diseases or whatever, I couldn't care less what other people do. But as it stands right now, picking up prostitutes is illegal. So that was to clarify my statement. That's what I meant by picking up a hooker being wrong, because while it may not be wrong to some people, according to the powers that be, it is.
I getcha. Again, I didn't mean to put you on the defensive. Just wanted to clarify for any listeners right now who are ready to pick up the phone and nail you one. Speaking of picking up the phone, if anyone has any questions or comments for Andrea Dean Van Goyak, that's a mouthful, you can give us a call, and that number would be 646-200-3136. You can also come to blogtalkradio.com/swapeast, and you will see a chat room there. I am able to read questions but unable to type or answer them, but I will look there for questions for Andrea if you're too shy to call in. But you shouldn't be shy. She doesn't bite, I've heard. Again, this is Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN. XXBN broadcasts using Blog Talk Radio out of Raleigh, North Carolina. I am Gracie Cassette, and I'm out of Fargo, North Dakota. All right, got all that out of the way. All right, now I have a few questions for you, Andrea, one of which is I did do some reading about you, and I read an article in which you expressed both your love of cemeteries and your need for hand sanitizer, which I thought was a very interesting combination. So tell us how you, first about the cemetery adoration, and then how you can do that if you're a love of and need a hand sanitizer all the time.
Well, I have always loved cemeteries, and I feel more at home in a cemetery than I do any place else. But I'm also a germaphobe. So if I happen to go do some work in a cemetery, my husband and I have adopted a local cemetery, and we go out there and we do some work in it. And if I forget to wear my gloves while I'm cleaning off a gravestone or something like that, I immediately break out my hand sanitizer.
And this would not be only relegated to the cemetery, then I imagine that you are not equally uncomfortable in a restaurant.
Oh, anywhere. If you've read my website or if anyone else goes to my website, I have a clinical fear of public bathrooms because they're just so nasty and disgusting. I will not use a public toilet unless I am absolutely desperate. And if I have to, I'm not only washing my hands, I'm hand sanitizing them, I'm pushing the door with my back, I'm using my elbows, and then I'm sanitizing my elbows. I'm a complete germaphobe. My friends laugh at me one day and say I'm going to end up like Howard Hughes.
It's entirely possible. I was going to say, now, do you take the germaphobe fear and do you turn that into, I mean, is that part of the driving of the horror synesteria for you, the creepy?
Oh, no, that has nothing to do with it. I wasn't a germaphobe until, gosh, just up until a few years ago. That's the one bad thing about being an adult. When you're a child, you don't know anything. It's like a friend of mine. She's getting ready to fly and go on a plane, and she's never been on a plane before. And she said, if I had gone 20 years ago, I wouldn't have cared. She said, but I'm an adult now, and I know that, let's see, the plane can crash. There can be a terrorist on the plane. Any number of things can happen. And I said, yeah, well, that's what sucks about being an adult, because when you become an adult, then all of a sudden all the things that you didn't think about when you were a kid, they're right there at the forefront.
So what got you into the horror and the creepy and the dark fiction?
I've always loved horror. I had a horror-loving aunt and uncle when I was a little girl, and I spent a lot of time with them. And they always had horror movies on. But, of course, back when, showing my age here a little bit, back when I was a kid, The Town That Dreaded Sundown was considered horror. And that was what I watched with them. And, of course, Jaws and a few others. And I spent so much time with them, it just rubbed off on me. I've always loved horror, and always will.
So when you consider that type of horror that you grew up watching, and you look at what's called horror now, do you have any comments on the differences?
Yeah, I think that horror so much now isn't horror, it's more gore fest, which is fine. I love good gore, just like anyone does. I've always had a love of gore being grossed out, and that's fine, but that's not horror, in my opinion. I am by no means an expert, but just my humble opinion is anybody can gross people out and sick them out, but there's not really anything scary about that. It's just sick. Now, like to me, Jaws and the remake, I didn't see the original thing, the one made in, I think it was the 50s, but the one made in the 80s with Kurt Russell. Okay, now The Thing, that to me is terrifying. But like House of a Thousand Corpses, what's the other one? Devil's Rejects. Those were not scary. That was not horror to me. That was just like, oh, yeah, they're splattering people all over the place. And, oh, this guy's in bed with a dead woman. Yeah, that's pretty cool. But I like to be scared. If I'm going to watch horror, I want to be scared. And so,
I was going to say the difference for me really is the when you see the gore and you see, you know, the spear going through the person, that's far less frightening than, let's say, Psycho, when you just see the shower curtain whip back and there's the dagger. I mean, your imagination
exactly
fills in things far, far more cruelly than if you were seeing them, I mean, as far as fear
exactly
goes.
What you don't see is far more scarier than what you see. It's just like in the original Alien. You didn't see the alien at all until toward the end of the movie. And that was terrifying because you had no idea. And then when you finally saw this thing, it was like, oh, my God.
So how do you go about trying to create that as an author, trying to control that to make it horror, to keep that suspense? You know, how do you decide is showing too much?
Well, actually, I don't consider what I write horror at all. I consider it more chilling, more macabre. But because of the subject matter and because of what I do write, such as vampires, zombies, shapeshifters, things like that, people consider that horror, so it automatically gets lumped into the same category with that. But I don't set out to scare my readers at all. I just set out to give them a good read. I would much rather, and I do the same thing with my magazine. I own two magazines. One's a dark poetry magazine, and then one's devoted to the creepy and macabre. I would much rather get a story that just makes me go, ooh, that is just so not right, than get a story that's, you know, Jason hacking people up, you know, hacking lovers up in a camp, whatever. I would rather get something that when I walk into a dark room, I'm like, okay, let me step back around the corner and turn on the light before I actually walk in there. That's what I would like to do for my fans, and that's what I hope I've done, because horror on a lot of levels, unfortunately, has been way overdone. I mean, it's just there's not really much more you can do with it. It's gotten to where now it's not Jaws and it's not The Thing anymore. It's cutting people's heads off and mutilating them sexually, and it's like, sorry, that's just not scary.
So you're exploring more of the again, I'm going to go with paranormal kind of thing, where we're exploring the what could be and parallels and where things touch rather than just straight out violence.
Right, right. I'm a really, really big fan of the noir, so that's a lot of what my works are too. They're just chilling and creepy. They're not scary. They're just like, ugh. Kind of give you a chill up the back of your neck and makes you want to turn around while you're reading the book to make sure there's no one behind you.
And you said you have vampires, zombies. What others are some of your other characters?
Witches, gypsies, shapeshifters. In A Man of Two Worlds, I even have an elf.
He sounds so friendly compared to the other ones.
Well, he's actually really stuck on himself, so I wouldn't exactly say he's friendly.
Well, without being stereotypical, he's male, right? So he's going to be
stuck. Right, he's male. I've got, in playing Devil's Advocate, which will be out in the next couple of years, I've got demons. I've got renegade demons. So I think I have touched upon every single character in the horror genre that there is. And even crossing over into dark fantasy, using a shapeshifter. Most of the time when you say shapeshifter, people think werewolves. Werewolves just aren't my thing. I've written like one werewolf story my entire life. So my shapeshifter, she's more like a chameleon. So I've got kind of the dark fantasy in there too with her and then the elf.
Now, why not write with humans?
Oh, I do.
I mean, Well, no, I'm not saying that your works are bereft of humans. But what is it, do you think, fundamentally that you're playing with or fascinated by when you use shapeshifters and vampires as opposed to a stock human character by comparison?
I honestly don't know. That's one of those weird questions that I can't answer because I write just whatever my brain tells me to write. I sit down, my brain has a story already in it. It's playing like a mini movie, and I just sit down and I start typing, and I don't stop until I'm done. And then I'll go back and read, and I'm like, wow. Am I sick and twisted?
Well, one of the things I've been struck by lately, there was that show on, I think it was CBS, it was after Ghost Whisper, it was The Moonlight. Have you guys heard of that?
I haven't heard of that, but I don't watch, I'm a total TV nerd. When I watch TV, I watch things like Cash in the Attic, Bargain Hunt, How Clean Is Your House, things like that. So it's like I am so totally on the other end of the spectrum because people are like, oh, you probably watch Chiller. No, I don't watch Chiller.
I don't know, but it seems like there's a plethora this past few years of, you know, you've heard of Ghost Whisperer, right? She talks to girls, she crosses them over, okay, and it gets kind of dark. It's not all light. I mean, they're cute and they're wrapped up usually in an hour, but this Moonlight was a vampire who really wasn't happy being a vampire and wanted to become human, back human again more than anything else, and there's the New Amsterdam. It's the guy who had helped an Indian tribe, and so when he was wounded in battle, they gave him the gift of everlasting life till he could find his true love or whatever. And I find this whole epic, gothic sweeping love of the undead, especially male, to be really fascinating. I think as a culture, we're kind of exploring the occult and using these paranormal creatures or immortal situations to explore the bigger questions of what is love and what is humanity. And I think also that, you know, we can explain commitment-phobic men who can't stay with you because they're vampires and they're going to live for eternity. So we don't expect them to be with one person forever. But I was just wondering if when you write your stories or when you go to conferences that you go at, if you've noticed any sort of general cultural shift towards these things as maybe exploring any general question?
I would say that more so than even over the past few years, I have recently, But honestly, and this is just my own personal opinion, and anyone who's listening, if you've never listened to me before, I'm really not a witch. I was going to say something else, but I didn't know if I could say that on the air or not. I'm really not. I'm just very brazen, very ballsy, and very in your face, and I say what I think. So this isn't to offend anyone out there, but all of the stuff that I see on the TV, like the TV shows that you were talking about, and a lot of the, won't name any names, but a lot of the other TV shows that used to be on, in my opinion, they're nothing but money-making gigs, because the gothic realm of life has been around forever. And I can promise you, 20 years ago, these shows that you're talking about wouldn't have gotten a second look. The books, like what I write, wouldn't have gotten a second look. But then the goth thing, the fad, got really big, and people saw it as a moneymaker, and it's like, oh, wow, we can put all this out. Oh, and it's still going. We're riding on the coattails now. We can still do all this. And so I really have a lot of distaste for things like that, because one of my favorite shows quite a few years back was Forever Night. It was a Canadian show about a vampire. It was just incredible. I mean, it was an absolutely wonderful show. And unfortunately for it, it was long before its time, and it didn't last on the air. And the sad thing was, it went off the air right before the fad hit. So had they been able to just stick it out even another year, it probably would still be on the air today, at least in syndication. So even though I'm seeing, when I go to cons and when I do book signings, I see a lot of this, I have to wonder how much of it is fad and how much of it is people like myself who have been a part of the darker side of life, so to speak, who've been goth since before it was a fad, before it was the cool thing. Elder goths, we call ourselves, people from my age bracket that were goth before, as we like to say, there was ever even such a thing in the modern times. So, yeah, it's popular at cons, it's popular at signings, but what's going to happen when it's not popular anymore? See, people like me will still be writing what I write now. I will continue to write what I write. And there will be a niche audience out there for it. But
well, there's always been, I mean, whether it's been called horror, I remember when I was growing up, I'm probably older than you, I'm in my mid-40s, and there was, Phyllis Whitney, I don't know if you ever heard of her, she did the gothic romances. And I remember reading a few of those, and they were very much the same thing. There was suspense and a fear or whatever. And, of course, there was the Harlequin-esque romance to it, which was why I only read, like, three of them, because they became very formulaic. But there's always sort of been what I guess, like you're saying, that there's this fad of goth right now. But I see that there's always been gothic with a capital G. Which goes back to the architecture, and before that, humans have always been interested in the what if of a darker side or an other world, if you will.
Right.
And I think I just interviewed someone a while ago, not on the show, but at Sex Kitten, Nikki Nines, who was writing about lamenting that she doesn't like the current quote goth movement because she thinks they equally miss the light in the dark, that they go so far into dark and sad and mopey, and I'm paraphrasing her and she'll probably yell at me, but that they go so far into that they forget that it's the contrast. It's where the light meets the dark and which one shifts for the other one. That is where the true interest lies.
Mopey stuff is emo, because true goth is not mopey at all. I mean, you can tell by talking to me. People walk up to me at conventions and they're like, okay, you are totally, if they've never seen me before, most people have, and most people will walk right up to me and they're used to how I am. But unfortunately, it has been so ingrained in the goth society that, oh, you have to want to die, you have to be suicidal, you have to cut yourself, you have to be sad, you have to be depressed. And people walk up to me and they're like, okay, you're smiling, you're laughing, you're talking to people, you're goofy. I've heard your interviews on the radio. You are absolutely nuts. You talk about doing your laundry. You talk to your cats while you're on the radio. And you're not what I expected. And then I just look at them and say, well, that's why you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. Because just because something dictates that a fad should be a certain way, that doesn't mean that it is and doesn't mean that it should be. I am the real deal. This is not a fad for me. I have been goth before there was ever a goth movement, so to speak, the recent one. Now, I was a little young back in the late, I'll say 70s, when it really picked up again. Now, a friend of mine is that generation, and she remembers when it came through the first time. And then it was called the British movement from over in England. And I said, that's the difference. This isn't a fad for me. I'm comfortable in my skin. I don't have anything to prove to anyone. And people look at me and they're like, oh, well, you're just not what I pictured. I thought you would be creepy and weird, and you wouldn't talk to me. I'm like, surprise.
Yeah, wouldn't that be horrible if you're an author and you'd be creepy and weird and wouldn't talk to anybody? I mean, that would be great for
That's what people expect. That is what people expect. They're like, I can't believe you're actually talking to me. I didn't expect you to. And I'm like, well, surprise, here I am.
Well, I've always found that sort of...
There's always been the niche out there, and there always will be. It kind of bothers me. I cannot stand the, and here's me getting on my soapbox again, I can't stand the jumping on the bandwagon thing. That's great that people need to make money, and that's great that people see something and they take advantage of it, but don't forget to remember it once the fad is over. Now, see, I write for my fans. I don't write for the big corporate. I don't write for anyone except for them. My fans are my life, my soul, my heart, end of story. As long as they want to read what I write, then I'll write it. But there's others out there that don't. And maybe one day, just speaking off the top of my head here, maybe one day those that are just looking to make money on the fad, once it's over with, they'll jump to something else. Where people like me, and don't forget this, people, if the gothic fad ever dies, my books will still be out there.
Well, I always think that the current gothic fad, as you're calling it, is so one-dimensional. It's so almost, and I'm sure we'll get hate mail, poser-ish. You know what I mean?
It is very poser-ish, and I can go on record and say that. It is poser-ish.
Well, it's sort of like wearing the knee pads and the wrist protectors and standing around the skateboard park, but, you know, you've never been on a board and you didn't know that it was called a deck, little, you know what I mean? You're just there to look the part. You don't actually do anything. And I guess that's where the difference between this, what I call gothic with a capital G and an IC on the end, as opposed to today's goths. Most of them that I meet are quite pessimistic and not really exploring, whereas I consider the traditional gothic and the kind of books that you're talking about and works you're talking about are exploring dark issues, but they're not, you know, necessarily all pessimistic and, you know,
exactly
very
right.
Black.
No, not at all. You'll find a lot of religion in my books, and a lot of people are like, oh, well, I thought goth was satanic and worshiping the devil, and I'm like, no, that's where you're getting the little poser people that are wannabes. That's where you're confusing them with what is real. Because I love anything. I love religious icons. I have rosaries all around my house. I have pictures of Jesus. I'm a very religious person, and I still write the creepy and the weird and the macabre. But that's because, like I said, I'm comfortable in my skin, and I can write what I like to write. But there's a big difference in the posers, and I find that the people that get offended when you use that word, most of the time it's because it hits a little too close to home.
Yeah, we're probably still going to get hate mail if they're not too pessimistic about sending it. It might be too much
okay,
effort.
They can send me hate mail. I'll just post it on MySpace and say, look, people hate me.
Hooray! All right, I'm going to mention again, this is called Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN, a media project of Swap East. If you have any questions for Andrea, you can call in at 646-200-3136 or post a question in the chat room.
Hey, call in and tell me how
lurking.
Much you
hate. Call in and tell us how much you love goth people and we're horrible. One of the things that I was going to mention, too, is when I mentioned to a friend that I was going to have you on and they weren't familiar with you at all, and I said, you know, Horace and Hysteria, and they're like, oh, is that like Stephen King?
That's funny because a lot of people have compared my works to Stephen King. Now, I've been called the next Anne Rice, and even though Anne Rice is awesome, and I love what she's done. She's brought the genre to the forefront. I have read a couple of Anne's books, and I see absolutely no similarities whatsoever.
Well, which ones of hers did you read?
I read Lasher and Taltos.
Did you read, oh gosh, no, I can't remember the name of it. I had
the
it
Mayfair
in my head
Witches.
When you were talking.
That's what everyone says to me. Have you read The Mayfair
no,
Witches?
No, it was actually not a really of, it was about the Jean de Calais, and it was before the vampire stuff. I'll have to, if I could peruse my bookshelf and not make a lot of noise, I would go do it.
I'm bad. I'm one of those authors that I don't read, and a lot of people laugh at me when I say that and say, no, it's the honest truth. I don't read. I spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, working on my own stuff because I'm so anal and so obsessive about making everything perfect. And then I've also got 2 collaborations right now that I'm working on. Plus, I've got my 2 magazines, which are a full-time job unto themselves. So, and two, me being so obsessive about my own work, the minute I pick up something, I go into edit mode, and that just automatically ruins reading anything for me. So people say, oh, your works are like Stephen King's then, I guess. And I say, well, people have said that I'm a combination of Stephen King, Dean Koontz, Michael, they have said, is like old-style Clive Barker, and then like A Man of Two Worlds and my novel Left to the Night Alone. They compare those to Laurel K. Hamilton and Poppy Z. Bright and Anne Rice. Now, I will gladly take a crumb of any of their fame, any of them, but I see absolutely no correlation between my works and theirs. But, hey, give me a crumb of that fame. I'll take it.
Now, have you read any Stephen King?
No, I have not read any Stephen King.
Yeah,
I've seen the movie Carrie.
You know, that's the thing is, every time anyone talks Stephen King, I've apparently read, except for The Green Mile, which I read in serialized form, working at a bookstore remember Walden Books? They have it at Halloween time, they have the calendar and the Halloween kiosks.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I was an employee in one of those when that came out. And there was no, you know, we always started that like 3 months before Halloween, and so no one was coming in. And so we were actually allowed to read, you know, as long as we were alert when people came in. And the only thing that was in the Halloween shop to read was Stephen King. So so I read Green Mile in serialized form. But the first book I read by him was Insomnia. I don't think that's ever been made into a movie, either feature or television. And I've never read any of the, like, Cujo, Carrie, and that stuff. So I don't really know what those things are like. But what I did read of, like, The Green Mile and the Insomnia were very interesting. They were very much the what-if, suspense-driven, scared and creeped out, but it wasn't about gore. You know, it wasn't about someone chasing me with a chainsaw, you know,
right,
running behind
right.
me. And so I would say that that's kind of similar, but I again haven't read your books. I would be lying to listeners if I said I had, but I mean, what you're describing sounds very much like that kind of Stephen King-ish work.
Yeah, it's more paranormal. I think my works are more paranormal. But I leave it to the readers to decide what they think of my books because, like I said, I write for them, that they are the only people that I write for. I don't care about impressing anyone except my readers because they're the ones who are going to buy my books. They're the ones who come to conventions to see me. They're the ones who send me the fan mail. They're the ones who take time out of their day to let me know that my books have touched them in some way. So they're the only people that I care in any way about impressing. So however they want to think of my books, that's fine.
So here's a question.
Some people are like, oh my gosh, well, I wouldn't want to be compared to anyone. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's obviously your own personal issue. I'm not that neurotic.
Yeah, here's my question. As an author, And your goal is to write things that, quote, creep people out and make them want to turn a light on before they enter a room. What is glowing praise from a reader? I mean, they can't say, oh, my gosh, I loved you. I met my husband or conceived my child, right? I mean, like, so, you know, like a love song or something. So big standard? What's the big standard to, like, when a fan writes, what is, like, the big thing that, you know, aha, they get me?
Let's see, when a fan emails me and tells me that they bawled their eyes out, that they hate me because of what I did to a character. I actually had a girl email in the other day. She finished reading my book, Left to the Night Alone, and she emailed me and said, I hate you, you B. I can't believe you did that to Ivana. And I'm like, yes, that's what I want. And then I've had some people that have emailed me about the two, and they're like, the book gave me nightmares. I was cold. I was actually freezing because it takes place in a frigid alternate world where there's no heat. And I've had people actually tell me that the book made them cold. I had the local manager, the ex-manager of the Walden Books by where I live, her fiancé would not allow her to read because she was one of the first people to read my book, The Two, when it first came out. And she said, my fiancé will not allow me to read The Two before bed because I wake up screaming with nightmares. I'm like, well, heck yeah, that's the best compliment you can give me. That and people telling me that they hate me because I did something to a character that they didn't like.
So this is a little perverse then. Your goal is to have people have nightmares.
Oh, yes, have nightmares.
So how do you sleep at night then?
Quite well, actually.
Do you think it's some sort of economic?
Huh?
Do you think it's some sort of economic or psychic trade-off where it's like, hey, if those 30 people read my book and have nightmares, then that's 30 less I'm going to have?
No, huh? No, I just think I've done my job then.
So let's talk about these conventions, because I myself have never been to these sorts of conventions. I've been to professional expos, and there's weirdos enough there. So I've never ventured into any of the, you know, the Star Wars and Star Trek conventions.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've never done any of that sort of thing. And I can only imagine what one would see, you know, when you're at some sort of horror expo. I don't even know what they call your expos. What do they call your expos?
Conventions.
Sci-fi and horror.
Yeah, sci-fi,
okay.
Horror. They have cool names like, oh, let's see, like Blood Con, Gothic Con. You know, they have cool names like that. Those are just two examples. I don't even know if there's a real con somewhere on the planet, but that's just an example.
And so, are people in costume? Are people in character? Do people think they're invisible?
Oh yeah. If you go to my blog on MySpace, in fact, tomorrow I'm going to be posting some pictures from the last con that I did in Miami. My computer's been on the fritz, so I haven't been able to do it, and I finally got it working again. But yeah, that's people go in costumes. You wouldn't believe some of the elaborate things that people wear. I was asked to judge a costume contest at Scout Con, which was a sci-fi horror convention that they had in Tampa. And I was a judge along with Aaron Gray from Buck Rogers, the old TV show Buck Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
And it was unbelievable, some of the costumes that these people had. They had Klingons. They had superheroes. They had Star Wars. And the people handmade all of these costumes. It was absolutely incredible.
Well, that's apparently what they do with their time, because they're not writing or folding laundry as neatly as you do.
Right, and talking to their cats.
But that's just a matter of priorities.
Yeah, see, I couldn't sit down and sew those outfits. I would have it thrown against the wall. I'd rip it apart, step on it, drag it on the floor. There's just no way I could sit down and do the costumes that some of these people did. It's amazing. But then I tell people, oh, well, I couldn't sit down and write a book. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess we're even then.
Yeah, I was reading something, I forget where, someplace on the internet, and an author was talking about her characters are so real, but in order to be able to, you know, she talked about, you know, the kind of like the din in her head with these people talking to her, kind of, and all writers sounded sane, so you know that's normal. And she was saying the only way that she could really clarify and synthesize and break them down to be able to write them was that she actually started sculpting them in clay. And by actually creating their physical selves and thinking about each one individually, that was the only way she could start separating before she wrote. And I thought, wow, that's rather amazing, because, you know, it's all I can do to vomit onto a page. You know?
Yeah, well, I couldn't sculpt anything in clay. I mean, that's just, wow, I can't even imagine, because I'd look at the clay, and if it didn't do what I wanted it to do, I'd have to throw it against the wall. I'd have to step on it. So it's like, no, I would.
Clay doesn't do anything. Clay just sits there literally like a lump.
Right, and no, I would just rather pour my time and energy and fight with the character on paper than fight with the clay and then try to fight with the character on paper too. Nah, that's just a little bit too much work for me. I'm lucky that my brain already has the story already played out like a mini movie, and I just sit down and let my fingers go.
Now, wasn't there a rumor that you were starting some movie or film production?
Yes, A Man of Two Worlds was in pre-production, but unfortunately the production company and I just simply couldn't come to a contractual agreement. So it has been shelved, but that's okay. I've got other people looking at it, and I've got other people looking at my short story, so there's always an offer here or there. So it's not a sad thing. I think my fans are disappointed, and I'm really sorry for them, but maybe one day.
How would you feel since you described, before we got on the air, in the green room, as we'll call it, you discussed a little bit about your perfectionistic, controlling nature, shall we say?
Yeah, just a little bit.
So how do you think you would actually be able to do if someone were to come up with the right offer and turn your novel into a movie? How would you think you'd be able to cope with that?
I'd be totally neurotic. I would be absolutely, totally neurotic because I have a certain idea. When I write my characters, I have an idea in my head of who I would like in case it gets turned into a movie, which I know is totally weird. But I write all of my books with the hope that someone will think it's cool enough to turn into a movie. And so I already have the characters pictured in my mind, which is why they're so descriptive in the books. And I already have in mind people that I would like to play them. So if, let's say I wanted, Brad Pitt to play a character, and the director wanted Harrison Ford, oh my gosh, my agent would have to just take me and lock me in a room somewhere because I would go insane.
So you would be tranquilized, and that would be your chance to work with Clay.
Yes,
look at
that would be
positively.
My chance to work with Clay. And so, I could work with Clay and I could sew because I'd be tranquilized.
I don't know if they'd let you have needles.
They probably wouldn't. My agent would be like, no, no needles.
No needles. So let's talk about some of your characters who you've seen as which movie stars.
Oh, my gosh, let's see. In my newest book that is out now, it went live on the 13th. It's going to officially be available on the market for purchase the 28th. That's Legacy, The Grounds of Nakma Sheehan, which is my first ever mainstream book. It's a pirate drama, pirate thriller adventure drama. If I had my choice, the character of Josiah would so be Adrian Paul from the Highlander TV show.
Yeah.
And let's see, Hampton would be Michael T. Weiss, who used to be on the TV show The Pretender. That's just a couple
yes.
of years. In A Man of Two Worlds, I would love to see the actor Scott Cleverdon. He's not a very well-known actor, but if you ever saw the movie Prophecy 3, he was Piriel, the angel out in the desert, the downcast angel. I would love for him to be Devon. And I'm thinking of David Boreanaz, maybe from the TV show Buffy and then later Angel, to be Robin.
So far you've really not picked any uggos.
Picked any who?
Uggos, you know, real ugly people. There are
none of your characters are ugly. Beautiful.
None of your characters are ugly.
Well, some of them are ugly inside. Like my character Kessler in A Man of Two Worlds, he's a total lecherous, disgusting creep. But he's not really all that bad looking. But you can't help but hate him. And in fact, though, I don't know who's sicker, me or my fans, because I hate Kessler with a passion, and I wrote him so people would hate him, and they love him. So go figure.
Well, it's
everyone
sort of like
Kessler's my favorite character, and I'm like, okay, you're just wrong.
Yeah, but that's like in every soap. I mean, the nighttime soap. Who becomes the most popular character? The villain everybody loves to hate. You love to hate him.
Exactly. And I thought in A Man of Two Worlds, the character of Rusty, who if that ever gets made into a movie, that'll be the one thing that I will actually put my foot down for and say, you have to hire my friend Daryl Baldwin. He's an actor and stuntman for MGM Studios. And he's like the epitome of Rusty. When it was in first negotiations, he contacted me about the part. And I looked at him and I was like, oh my gosh, I never even knew that you existed. And yet, if you read the description of Rusty, it is you. And he started laughing.
Yeah.
But I figured he would be the one that everyone would love, and he would be the one that everyone would be out there emulating, kids running around with a bald head, black shirts with no sleeves, black pants, you know, muscular sunglasses, stuff like that. No, everyone likes Kessler, the weirdo, creepy lech. So,
well, you know, we all have uncles like that, maybe.
Yeah, that just shows that I have no clue, though.
All right, this is Cult of Gracie Radio on XXBN. We're using Blog Talk Radio to broadcast to you live tonight. If you have any questions for author Andrea Dean Benskoya, the number is 646-200-3136. I want to switch gears a little bit after, you know, fantasizing pop culture with actors. One of the things that I think is in common with your genre, no matter what you name it or how you view it, along with erotica and sex in general this day and age, is censorship. So I thought you might, since you're putting out a magazine and you're interested in getting your books on shelves and your publications out there, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on censoring.
I'm 100% totally, no qualms about it, against censorship in any form. I am
excellent.
One of these,
I'm high-fiving you.
Yeah, I'm one of these terrible people that believe that there should be no labels on music saying that it's got explicit lyrics. There should be like no controls on the TV to keep kids from watching whatever. It should be up to the parents to say, look, I'm your parent and I don't want you watching this, so don't watch it or you're going to be grounded. I don't believe it is up to the government. It's up to bookstores. It's up to music stores. I don't believe it is up to anyone except for parents of children. And then as adults, we should not be censored in any way. That's supposedly one of the joys of being an adult. You can watch what you want to watch, and you don't have to have someone standing over your shoulder saying, oh, that's not right. You shouldn't be doing that. I can't stand censorship. I think it's useless.
Now, when it comes down to your types of work, even though your works aren't particularly violent, let's say with rape, that's clearly violent, clearly there's, you know, the battle cry, you know, kind of like sex too, is think of the children, but there's going to worry that the people are going to emulate what they're reading. And I'm sure to your knowledge, no one has actually thought they were a shapeshifter based on reading your books. But
yeah, thank God. I'm still waiting for someone to contact me and say, oh, I'm actually this character, and I'll be like, okay, whatever.
But, you know, what about somebody who you know, uses that as the reason to censor, you know, let's say one of your works, or a store won't carry it on their shelves because of the topic? I mean, what is your, aside from the fact that we're adults and should have the rights, if they say, well, the community is going to object, what would you say?
I've actually had people not want me to, there's a local library, not my complete local one is in my area, because the woman that runs that one, she's got the same thoughts I do. There should be no such thing as censorship. It should be up to each individual adult to read what they want to read, and it should be parents, you know, that thing. But there's another local library that I tried to contact, and I guess I made the, you know, quote-unquote mistake of putting the picture of Michael as the front picture for the press kit. Oh, they wouldn't even get back with me. They wouldn't even contact me about coming in there and having a signing. And I just think that's ridiculous. A library of all places.
Can you describe the cover to people listening so they have an idea of what the problem was?
It's a shirtless guy standing in the middle of a cemetery with his eyes closed.
And so man nipple is now frightening?
Yeah, I guess. Or maybe they thought it was too sexy or too racy or whatever. But I was absolutely appalled. So I called the friend of mine that runs this other library, and I said, I cannot believe this library doesn't want to have me in. I said, a library of all places, a library censoring someone. And she's like, yeah, welcome to the world as it is today. I said, that's crazy. I tell people, because I won't even let my own son, he's 17, I won't even let my own son read my works. Yeah, that's my personal choice. I will not let him read my works until he becomes a technical adult. And I tell parents, because my book covers are really cool. And I always go to the cons in full gothic dress. And so a lot of the young girls will come running up to my table because they think I'm really cool looking, and they'll pick up one of my books. And I'm like, no, sweetie, you have to have your mom's permission before you can read that. So I do my part, even though a lot of people will say, oh, well, you say you're against censorship. But I'm like, yeah, that's totally different. I am not going to make the decision for someone else's child. I'm not going to say, oh, yes, you're only 11 years old, but you should buy Michael, even though it's got twisted rape scenes and sexual mutilation and all kinds of stuff. Go ahead and buy it. No, I'm not going to do that. I will tell the parent, look, this is what's in the book. Now, if you want the kid to have it, then you tell me you want them to have it. I'm not going to sell the book to the kid otherwise. But as an adult, I just find it appalling that someplace like a library, when I clearly say, okay, now this is the age group that my books are geared toward, they won't even give their adult patrons the chance to get to know me.
And why? Have they said to you why? What their philosophy is?
Oh, absolutely not. They wouldn't even return my email. I called them and I said I wanted to make sure that you got my press kit because I have a professional press kit that I send out. I've been doing this a while. I'm not just some fly-by-night hack. I have three agents. I have a professional press kit. I have all that. So I said, here you go. Here's my press kit. Have a look if you have any questions. Hey, you don't even have to go through my agent. Feel free to call me. They wouldn't even call me. They're like, yeah, we've got it. And I was like, okay.
So now as a parent, when you hear these claims and, one of the ones is, kids are going to read horror books or scary books and the creepy and especially with this poser goth movement and children who have been shooting up at schools, whether it's high school or colleges, they want to draw these connections between the reading material and the behavior. Neither one of us are necessarily research fellows who are going to point out studies, but, we all know that, you, for instance, have been watching scary movies in some genre or another since you were, what, 7 or 8?
5.
Okay, 5. and to my knowledge, you've never, done anything violent in your life. In fact, you're a cemetery caretaker, which is pretty benevolent.
I'm happily married for 14 years. I am an animal rights activist. I feed stray cats outside. My house is full of what were once stray cats. I, like you said, I take care of a cemetery. I help up-and-coming authors for free. I don't charge them, oh, give me $50 and I'll tell you all my secrets. I have authors email me every single day, and they probably hate me afterward because they're like, look, I just wanted some pointers. I didn't want an entire book. And I'll send them a 2 or 3 page letter about things they can do to help kickstart their career. I'm, like I said, in a stable marriage. I am very happy, well-adjusted. I have a nice home. I go places. Yeah, so the whole, you have to blame books and you have to blame music because kids go nuts, that is all crap as far as I'm concerned. Because I am living proof that you can watch sick, twisted, debauched, crazed things. And it's all up to the individual person as to whether or not they're going to allow that to affect them. Because there's a difference. People, that's another thing that gets people with me. They'll come up to me and they'll say, but I cannot believe as you're normal. And I say, well, yeah, for lack of a better word, define normal. But I guess if you're thinking like Susie Homemaker standing behind the white picket fence, that kind of normal, yeah, I guess I kind of sort of am. And they're like, but you can write such sick and twisted books. And I say, well, yeah, you know why? Because they're books. It's not real. It's not based on anything real. I have a firm grasp on reality. I don't combine the two. I don't have identity issues.
What do you think drew that line for you? I mean, was it your parents or your aunt and uncle when you watched the movies? I mean, what really made that clear to you that this is a movie or a book? And it's a fiction, and it's a what-if, and yeah, it may be dark, but it's a thought, it's not an action, as opposed to it's something that you harbor and that you plan to carry out.
Oh, no, I never at any point, at any time, I never had to make that distinction. I knew if it was on TV, it wasn't real, unless it was like a newscast. But I've always had a firm grasp on reality. And
do you credit your parents with that at all, you had to get that somewhere.
Well, I guess, if anything, my parents. I mean,
you pass that on to your son?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, my son was watching horror movies with me at 3 years old. And I'm like, okay, now you know all this stuff on TV is fake, right? And he's like, in his little baby talk, Mommy, it movie. And I'm like, okay, just as long as you know. And even today, I'll see something on TV and I'll say, well, that's special effects. And he's 17, and he's, Mom, it's fake. I know. And I'm like, well, sorry. In my eyes, you're still three.
The curse of the child-parent relationship.
Right, the curse of kids growing up. But no, I've always had a firm grasp on reality, and it's really sad for those people that don't, and they feel the need to blame music, they feel the need to blame movies, whatever. That's ridiculous, and that's passing the buck, and I won't even get on my soapbox about that because I could go seriously off on people passing the buck, no one taking responsibility for their own actions.
That's true. Now, when you were young and you watched these movies, when did you start writing? What age?
Around 13.
And did you have one of those dark, creepy notebooks with little skulls drawn in the corner? And
not skulls, but I used to write all my creepy stuff in there. I wish I still had that notebook because I would love, even though I would probably either laugh hysterically or cry because the story was so bad, but I would love to be able to find the first story I ever wrote when I was 13. I used to have all my friends read it, and they were like, yeah, whatever, it's weird and creepy like you. That's what they'd say to me.
So what if your parents would have found it?
My mother probably did read it, and she would critique it. You've got this misspelled. Because she'd say, you need to work on your spelling. You need to work on this. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And it never occurred to me that she had probably found the notebook and read. And instead of being appalled, she's like, no, you misspelled words. You need to work on your spelling. And it just, I was like, okay. I always thought she was talking about my schoolwork.
Well, that's kind of interesting because most parents today, you know, they are supposed to put their child in counseling, right?
Oh, yeah. They jump the gun and they immediately panic. And it's like, oh, give me a break. That's going to make the kid even worse. I had a lady walk up to me one time. I love the novelty store Spencer's. I love that place. For like 2 or 3 years in a row, I worked there at Halloween because I could get some really great discounts on stuff. So I'd come home with like all the statues and things that they have out at Halloween. And this lady walks in one day, the wild-eyed look, and she says, oh, my son or daughter, whatever it was, is into the goth thing. And I don't know what to think about it. And I looked at her and I said, okay, well, I'm about as goth as you can get. And guess what? I don't wear black every day. And I'm not suicidal. But you've got what looks like a railroad spike around your neck. And I had a really cool nail around my neck with a hole in it with a little leather chain thing around it. And I picked one up off the wall because I'd actually gotten it at Spencer's. And I handed it to her, and I said, turn the nail over and look at it. And she looked, and I said, in case you can't read it, it says John 3:16. It's a representation of the spikes that were driven into the wrists and ankles of Christ. And her eyes grew about as big as serving saucers. And she said, but I don't understand. And I said, that's because you need to quit panicking and you need to quit freaking out and jumping the gun. And you need to actually sit down and do some research. She's like, oh, well, thank
you. And talk to the son or daughter, whoever it was.
Right. Instead of freaking out and thinking that they're going to start cutting their wrists and jumping off the nearest bridge they can find. You know, if the kid is going to do that, goth did not make them do that. They had the propensity for that always, and I guess they just found an outlet for it.
Yeah.
Because look at how many people do that and aren't goth. So, you know, what excuse are they going to use? There I go on my soapbox again, you know, about the passing the buck and not accepting responsibility thing.
We've only got a little over a minute left. I don't know if you want to stick around and talk a little longer or if you want to get going, but in either case, I wanted to mention the time to you.
We can talk until they kick us off.
Okay.
You can tell I have no shortage of things to talk about.
For those listening right now, in about a minute or so, live streaming is going to end, and the only way you'll be able to listen live is to call in at 646-231-36. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait till we're done talking and Blog Talk Radio converts the files to MP3s and has them available for download. Again, if you want to listen live, that would be 646-231-36. All right, so my question to you along with this, you find it in your kid's room, the notebook with the, you know, something creepy and alarming. You know, parents shouldn't panic. I think a huge part of this is just like if you found your child with a Playboy, should probably talk to them about what's reality versus what's fake. Make sure that they have a, you know, ability to reality check themselves before you assume there's a problem.
Right. When did that change? When did parents start freaking out and acting like a bunch of panicked cattle from when the parents used to say, oh, so you snagged my Playboy, huh? You know, when did that change?
Well, I think one of the big differences is that people, you know, you always hear, oh, kids today, as if kids today are so much worse than kids, you know, in the generation or the three beforehand. And I think something's happened to the parents recently. I think this, it's not me, I have no responsibility. You know,
exactly.
I want the government to scream stuff. Yeah, I want the government to screen my books and music so I don't have to pay attention to what my child's consuming.
Right,
you know?
I don't mind being a parent, but I don't want any of the responsibility.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing. If you know what your kid's interested in, whatever it is, I mean, bluegrass music can be horribly frightening if a person's, you know, dancing with it and poking themselves with a knife. I mean,
right.
You know, the behavior is one thing, and if they're, for whatever reason, you know, prone to harm themselves or others, what they're reading or what they're doing isn't necessarily, you know, the same thing. There's a difference.
Exactly. That's what I said. If the kid is going to jump off a bridge or cut themselves, goth is not going to make them do it. Well, it's like my stepdaughter came home when she lived with us for a while when she was younger, and she came home one day and she said, Mom, have you ever heard the song I'm a Loser Baby? And I said, yeah, by Beck. And she said, yeah, that's it. She said, I wrote on my notebook at school, I'm a loser baby, and the teacher asked me if I needed to talk to someone. I said, well, you tell the teacher to mind their own business. I said, that's ridiculous. I said, you can assure the teacher that you have a stable home life and you have two parents that care, and she needs to shut her mouth and quit acting like some Nazi militant moron.
But on the other hand, the other kids that maybe don't have parents who are willing to actively parent are expecting these teachers to catch things through the cracks. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so the teacher's
and I just
probably feeling this double-edged sword of, I do nothing, then who's the second person named in the lawsuit when, you know.
Right, and that just, you're right, that's a double-edged sword, and I really have a problem with that, because if you're going to have the kid, be responsible for it. Don't expect everyone else to raise your kid for you. You know, that's just, that's how I am. I mean, I did with my stepdaughter when she came home and she said, oh, well, the teacher got upset because I wrote that on my notebook. And I said, you tell the teacher to mind her own business. And if she has a problem with what you're doing, she's more than welcome to call me. And she never did.
I'm curious here. As in the parenting side of things, you have a 17-year-old son, and you're saying, no, he can't read the books because there's a magic number of 18.
Right.
I'm assuming you've done some preparation for him. I mean, aside from things on TV, I mean, you've had to have conversations with him. You're not expecting that there's actually a magical thing that happens at 18, are you?
Oh, no. And he's my
stepson. He's not going to be a shapeshifter, is he?
Right. No, he's my stepson. He's not my birth son. So, but I refer to him as mine because my husband's quite a number of years older than me, and he's actually the only one of my husband's kids that could be mine. The rest, my oldest stepson's only 6 years younger than me. So, so when I say my son, I feel like he's mine. But no, I've raised him the best that I can, and I know when he's at his mother's house, because he's got an older brother, so I'm sure he's seen sex movies. I'm sure he's seen Playboys. I'm sure he's seen all kinds of stuff. And he goes.
Might have read your book.
Right. For all I know, he may have read my books. I mean, I've had kids come running up to my table, like 16 years old. Oh my God, I can't believe I'm actually getting to meet you. I loved your book. And I'm thinking, where did you get a hold of my book? Because I certainly didn't sell it to you. But so, you're right.
And again, they're sold at Walden Books. You don't need an age to buy them. I mean, they're not sold in a wrapper. They're not protective materials.
Exactly. So it's like, even though I try to do the best I can to be a responsible parent, you can't censor everything. I mean, there's going to be some things, like you said, my son he's seen all kinds of stuff on TV. His older brother has shown him God knows what. And I don't have any control over that. His older brother is in his 20s. I don't have any say over that. So when he gets 18, he'll probably be able to teach me a thing or two on the front. I say, well, do you know about this? And he'll probably be like, yeah, let's sit down and let me tell you all about it. He'll probably shock me. But I have tried to be responsible just for my own peace of mind.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's some lesson here for parents as far as those who might be thinking, well, maybe I am being too wrapping them in bubble wrap and letting the government and other things, you know, set these limits for me, and I'm not educating them. Because, you know, the other side of this is these people that won't let them watch anything on TV, read, you know, get a Playboy, you know, which, by the way, I find very weird because Cosmos are laying around on everybody's coffee table, but Playboys are hidden, and I don't see much of a difference between the two. You know, women's fashion that they show on Cosmo could, you know, and the health articles are,
well, my,
you know,
books tend to be a little more graphic and a little more depraved and twisted than most. It's like I can watch a horror movie, and it's like, oh, please, that's nothing. My books are worse than that. So I don't let my son read my books just because they are, like, really way twisted and sick and graphic, although I'm sure he could handle it. Still, whatever he's seen movie-wise, I think he's seen.
Right, well, I'm getting to the point of the preparation, because if there's other parents who are saying no, 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 can't, censor, 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 which they have a right to, but at some point you have to be bringing up the baby to the point that they are going to hit 18 and they're going to have access to these things, and if they, you know, they go from all to nothing, if there's
right.
been no conversations about the distinctions and the fact that you're saying this is a fictional work exploring a dark area, and while I've written about rape, I'm certainly not pro-rape. When you read it, and if you buy it and read it, it doesn't mean you're pro-rape. You know what I mean? That
exactly. Well, I've told him things like that. When you read my book, just remember, when you read my books, because I don't know which one he's going to read, just remember that it's fiction. None of it's real. And he's like, well, yeah, I know. And if he were my birth son and he actually lived here with me, I could watch horror movies with him. I mean, he's the one that got me over my fear of the movie Event Horizon, and you know how graphic that movie is. But
no, I don't. I don't watch a lot of that gore stuff.
Oh, Event Horizon is great. But as for, like, my own personal twisted books, now, he had already seen Event Horizon. He laughed at me because I was afraid of it, because he had already seen it, and he probably saw it with his older brother. But I have his mother to think of. I mean, I have to answer
right.
to her if I get out of line. Now, if he were my birth son, I'd be like, yeah, you can read this if you want, but just bear in mind that just because I have rape in this book, that doesn't mean that you are to be pro-rape. It doesn't mean that you're to go out and rape women. You know, I could do that with him, but
mm-hmm.
like I said, I have his mother to answer to. So I have to be a little bit more, for lack of a better word, censored than I would
right.
be if he were my actual birth son. I'd be like, yeah, read whatever you want. Watch whatever you want. If you have a question about something, come to me. We'll talk about it. Just realize that this is fiction. It isn't real. Just be sure that you have a firm grasp on reality between the two. And if you have any problems along the way, come see me and we'll talk.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I think that's missing. You know, I was talking with Sarah of Early to Bed. She runs it was the first women's sex toy shop in Chicago. And we were talking about, we think something's been missing from sex education, and we're not really sure. I mean, we know a lot's missing factually. But we think there's lots of other things missing. And this is sort of the same thing with horror and scary or gory things, is that same sort of gap of conversation. Because if things are being censored, whether by the government or in the home, you know, if the parent is saying no just because it's got that TV symbol on it, and not explaining to their kids why or talking with them, if there's no relationship for these conversations, then what happens is kids have to turn to one another in a peer group, you know?
Right,
and
God knows what they're going to learn.
Yeah, well, because it's like, you know, I've got a niece, she wants to be a vet. You know, and I was telling her the other day, her mom and I were talking with her, and we were saying, you know, we know you're going to think in some ways it's gross to talk to us about sex when you're, you know, older. But if you don't talk to us, to the school counselor, talk to the teacher, ask a question here, you know, we're listing off resources for her, and saying, because, you know, you talk about being a vet, but you wouldn't go and over to your best friend Sarah's house and say, okay, teach me how to be a vet today. You know, she knows nothing. And so you wouldn't ask your peer about, you know, why would you ask your peer about sex or about, you know, rape or you know, insert scary topic here, you know, drugs, sex, rock and roll, whatever. Because they don't know either. You know, you have to go to someone who has some experience with these things. So you have to do it. And I think there's this widening gap that not parenting is encouraging here of these kids having to turn to peers because there isn't, you know, an adult willing to have the conversation because they've been left to their own and just completely stripped of the ability to choose and understand by themselves.
Right. Well, when my stepdaughter lived with us, because she would go to a lot of parties and things like that, and I always told her, anytime you need to talk to me about anything, you can. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to get mad at you. Come in and we'll talk if you have questions about whatever. And that was one of the things that she loved about me, because she said, I can talk to you about anything. And she said, that's great. She said, because I don't want to feel like that I'm in trouble if I have questions, and I don't want to feel like that I'm going to get in trouble if I've been to a party where people were smoking pot. She said, I didn't smoke any, but people were there and they were smoking it. And I said, well, I'm glad that you didn't smoke it. That's great. And I'm glad that you've trusted me enough to where you could come tell me that, yeah, I was at a party, Mom, and people were smoking pot. I didn't do it, but people were. And we had, and we still, to this day, we've got a great relationship because she knew that she could talk to me and I wouldn't be like, oh, I can't believe you did that. You're not ever going to do that again. You know,
yeah.
That doesn't solve anything.
Well, I think that's the big thing here, whether, you know, whatever the taboo is, whether it's a scary book, a scary movie, or, you know, sex or drugs or things like that, people just are skipping these conversations and just saying it's, you know, it's a nothing world. We're going to censor everything. We're not going to let you. We're just going to say, no, that's for adults, and not say anything else about it. And then, wham, they hit that magical age where they're allowed to. And even if they don't want to rush right out and buy it or immerse themselves in it, you know, they're going to be asked to go to a bar, and somebody is going to be, you know, doing something. They're going to be in a situation where they're going to be held responsible for their actions, and yet they've had no basis or training for these things.
Right, which is why I always tell people I must be like a closet hippie, because that's what they consider the hippies, you know, are the liberals that are into everything. And it's just like, well, I don't consider that being liberal. I consider that, tell your kids that they can talk to you. And don't sit down for heaven's sake, do not sit down and act like you're going to put the poor kid on trial. Sit down and say, hey, sit down. Come on, let's talk. What do you want to talk about? Not, okay, now let's sit here and we need to discuss this. Oh, my God, I would rather not discuss it than talk it over with someone who's going to be like that. Because
yeah,
that's going to make the kid uncomfortable. When I would talk to my stepdaughter, I'd go sit in a room and I'd be like, hey, what happened at the party tonight? You okay? Did anything go on? Made you feel weird? And she's like, oh, well, you know, some people were being really stupid, Mom, and I'm glad I don't act like that. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's cool. Now you see how not to act. I mean, it was just totally casual. And that's the one thing that I always, because I can't have children of my own, and I always thought that I would be a really cool mom, because my kids could come to me and talk to me about anything, and I wouldn't be judgmental, and I wouldn't, like, sit them in a chair with a spotlight on them and stupid crap like that, like my parents did me. You know, God love them. I know they did the best job that they could. You know, whoever gets a manual about how to be a parent and knows how to follow it. I mean, there's tens of thousands of them out there, but how do you know that the person who wrote the manual knew what they were talking about? You know?
Well, we have bigger requirements on getting a pet from your local animal shelter than we do on becoming a parent. So
true. That's very true. And I know that my generation, you know, sex was taboo and it was something that you talked about in hushed whispers. And I would tell my daughter flat out when she'd come home, I'd be like, if you ever have questions about sex, you need to talk about birth control, you come talk to me. And she's like, okay, that's cool, Mom. I'm glad I can talk to you about it. I did not make her feel like that I was going to send her off to some kind of Amish commune or something.
I don't think they allow people in from the outside. But, you know, this was something we were talking about the other day, too, about sex education. With Sarah again from Early to Bed was this thing where I'm very concerned about 20-something people, especially women who seem to be of the idea that they can have sex kind of like the good old boy stereotype of a man, love them and leave them, you don't need to know last names. Even though sex education is currently hideously wrong in its presentation of the simple biology and the scientific fact, we're grossly missing, and this really come from the home, but this component of love and affection attachment, that sex and love are not mutually exclusive. They're best when they're together, but that they do happen independently. You can love somebody and not have sex. You can have sex with somebody and not love them, but how to protect your heart as well as, you know, your genitals from an STD. You know, I mean, there's other things that you're at risk for besides pregnancy and HIV.
Right.
And I think that's a lot of that conversation that's missing, which is the same thing with horror and gore movies. Gore movies do nothing for me. Suspense. I was trying to think since the beginning of this interview of this movie. I think it's called Carnival. It's an old, like, 1940s movie or something, and zombies at a carnival. I don't know. I can't remember any of the rest of it.
Oh, yeah. I think I've heard of that movie, yeah.
And it's very creepy and scary, and it leaves you very unnerved at the end, you know, because it's like, part of your brain is like, I don't even know what I just saw, what happened. There's the car accident, then they get taken to a car. It was very weird. Anyway, you know, if you don't have conversations about those things, if you just say all those movies no until you're 18, then you can make your own choice about them. How do they make a choice when there's this no information available? You know?
Right, right. That's true. And sex education in school, back on that for a minute, I know that for anybody who's, I don't know if people are still listening or not, but if anyone's wondering what that weird noise is, it's my electric cat toilet. just a little bit of useless information there. In school, they also make you feel like that you're some kind of creepy weirdo because you're taking sex ed. You've got the teacher standing there, and instead of being cool, they're like, okay, now we must discuss how you use a condom. We must discuss birth control. And it's like, oh, no, I think I'd just rather leave.
Well, and they tune out. I was talking, because I think I'm a little older than you, and there was we had a class. It was after the fourth grade and the ninth grade kind of mandatory sex ed classes. There was this, it was called a relationships class, and it was held by the two teachers in the school who were the least intimidating. I mean, like physically, they were like 4 feet tall, pale, old. Even she was balding. You know what I mean? And they both had the little grade school teacher voices. And they would, that's how they tell you to stop running in the hallway.
Oh,
And a bunch of people, a bunch of boys signed up for this class thinking it was going to be the world's easiest credit. You know what I mean? They were going to get their credit for whatever class it was, you know, health or whatever, the easy way with these two teachers. And they were going to run roughshod over these teachers. And we got in there, and there was like, oh, maybe 20 of us. And it was only like three girls because all these boys rushed to get in it as soon as they heard. And what they did is they actually, one of the lesson plans they had was they were trying to talk about a song, and I forget what song they had picked, and they were going to talk about the love and the relationship and what it meant. And a couple of the boys in the back were making fun of the song and, you know, old, corny, whatever. And so then we were all told to bring in a 45 because this is the day of vinyl. We're all supposed to bring in a record, an album or a 45 that we wanted to play for the class as far as felt it defined relationships for us. And one of the boys brought in American Woman. You know, she's a fast machine. She kept her motor clean, okay?
Right.
And they drop the needle on it, and they play it, and, you know, the two teachers in the front, very old-fashioned, tapping their toe, nodding their head to the rock and roll music, you know? And the boys were just singing out the lyrics, and they thought they were really going to intimidate these teachers. And, of course, the three girls, we were just blushing like crazy because, you know, that we felt very intimidated in the setting. Well, they played the song all the way through, and then they asked, if the female said something to the boys about, like, well, what is it about this song that you like as far as relationship? And one of the boys yelled, she's a fast machine. Another one yelled, she keeps her motor clean. And then someone else started yelling, the teacher put her hand up. She said, okay, to the first one, she's a fast machine. What does that mean? And she one by one had to, she broke these kids down. I mean, they, by the end of it, I thought two of them were going to cry. Because they were so
cool.
It was. I mean, the three girls, we could feel our, you know, we weren't just it wasn't just our bosoms growing. We were just swelling with pride and feeling so light by the end of class. Because she was like, well, kept her motor clean and, you know, made him talk about STDs. Does that mean that she's been around a lot? Is that a bad thing? Is there a stereotype about a girl who's been around? Is that the same for boys? If she takes care of herself, if she's been with somebody and she uses a condom and, you know, really made these guys talk about it. And it was the best class ever. I mean, it's like 30 years later or whatever. I'm still talking about it because it really put the boys thought they were on the offense and instantly they were shifted to defense. And they had to articulate what it was about a relationship and attraction and sex and what was different when they wanted sex versus when they wanted a relationship and how to tell the difference and what to be aware of. And instead of telling them STDs are bad, use a condom, the kids are, you know, we already knew that in the class, even though that wasn't, you know, quite the HIV days yet. You know, we knew that.
Right, pregnancy was the big thing back then.
Yeah, but I mean, we knew that, and it was, you know, what was the difference? If, you know, what does promiscuity mean? Did it mean one car, you know, and everybody had a chance to kind of be under the laser light bulb there and have to answer, you know, what was promiscuity mean? Was it a number of partners? Was it the emotional level involved? Was it, you know, and it was really interesting. And I thought, that's the kind of stuff that needs to be discussed today, because that's what kids are so disjointed out. They I really think most kids know and understand the biology. I think most parents take the time to do that. I don't think schools do it very well. And I'm hoping parents catch that. But I think that in general we're missing that whole conversation about, you know, about these issues, which for you as a horror writer is the same sort of thing. I mean, what you're writing about rape and you're talking about when it's integral to the plot and what that means about the character, not just I'm gonna write something here for, you know, one-handed use.
Right. Now, because I'm not out to shock my readers. I want what I write to have meaning. I don't want the story, I don't want my readers to read it and be like, okay, and that served what purpose? It's going to serve a purpose in my book. It's going to have a reason to be in there. Oops, dropped the phone. Sorry. Now I'm arranging my pantry. I've read books where people have just put gratuitous whatever in there, and it repulsed me. I had to write a review one time of a book, and it was just sex, 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 just mindless sex. And I wrote the person back, and I said, this is the worst piece of schlock crap I've ever read. I'm not trying to hurt your feelings, but I'm telling you, this is nothing but schlock crap. There's no storyline. You can't just have effing all through the book without a storyline. And the person emailed me back and thanked me for pointing that out to them. But that's what I can't stand is when it's gratuitous. And unfortunately, that could be the type of people who write that could be the ones that never got any kind of education in school or from home or anything.
Yeah.
So they don't
I'm really intrigued that as a female author that, you know, what goes through your mind when you're writing about rape. Because that is such a visceral violence.
To me, it's just words. No, to me, it's just words. It's another thing I've got. I mean, it's reprehensible, and when I'll go back and read some things, it'll make me cringe, but it's part of the story, and I look at it from a business point of view. It's part of the story, and it needs to be in there.
Right, but what makes that... I'm not trying to go with the why would you want to shock people or why would you glorify, because I know it's none of those things. But I mean, when you write about that, you have to be crafting the horror and the disgusting things about it. So even though while you're writing it and you're forced, compelled to move the story, and that's part of the story. But what is the? I'm fumbling over a question. Really, I am. What is it for you that is the lesson or the reason for it? You know, pick one of your books, you know, and go with that. But I mean, why would it be rape and not, you know, murder or robbery or, you know, why that specific crime?
Probably in Michael, the rape scene that I have in there of him with the prostitute was just, it just happened. He happened to be out on the street. He was walking around. He was getting used to his new body. He was looking at people and how they behave because he wants to trick Taylor into thinking that he's a human. that he's actually just like him. He doesn't want him to know that he dug himself out of his grave and he's never had a body before, and yes, he wants to pass as human, so he's people watching. And him picking up this prostitute, she's like, hey, baby, you want to have a good time? And he's like, okay, because he figures that's what a regular person would do. And the fact that he kills her afterward, it's because she upsets him, and he's not totally human. He's new in this body, and he doesn't know how to express himself any other way. So there's really no lesson there. That just happens to be a matter of circumstance. And that's what a lot of mine are. I don't really teach lessons, so to speak, because I'm not out to preach to people in my books. A lot of times...
No, but I mean, but the very fact that it's you know, not just being illegal, but it's reprehensible, and that he doesn't know the right and wrong of it, per se, like you or I would, or the reader hopefully does, but that these are... I don't want to say shocking because I'm not saying they're there to shock the reader just for a gratuitous entertainment value, but that they're, you know, murder and rape are big things. They're not taboo from when we don't talk about them. They're taboo because they're horrific to do.
Yeah, I guess I don't have a simple answer for that because I don't write like any other author, and I don't write with the same mindset as any other author. All I can tell you is I write what I write, and when you read the stories, you'll see their purpose in there. But just me personally, I don't set out to do anything. I write my books, I write them the way they are, and they just come out the way they do, and the scenes that are in there just happen to be what's in there. I know that sounds probably totally lame, but I simply am not like any other author on the planet. At least that I found, and I talk to a lot of authors, and all of them tell me the same. You're not like any other author I've ever spoken with. So,
what do they think your answer should be? I mean, give me an example of how you're different.
They think I should have a formulaic answer. They think that there should be a rhyme and a reason, and there should be a purpose for every single thing I do. And it's like, no, sorry, that if you're looking for me to be any form of normal, for lack of a better word, if you're looking for me to follow any formula, if you're looking for my answers to be neat and tied up all pretty with a bow in a box, it's not going to happen. I don't write like any other author, and I don't necessarily do things with any reasoning behind it. I write my story, it works, and that's all I can tell people. And a lot of people appreciate that, though, because they don't want to be boxed in either, and they want to know that it's okay, that they can write things, and it doesn't have to fit a formula. It doesn't have to fit in the box. It doesn't have to have a reason behind it.
Now, you mentioned that you don't do a lot of reading now. Did you do a lot of reading when you were younger?
No. Well, let me see. Reading when I was younger. Not really, I read like mystery books and things like that, and I used to really, really, really be into the choose your own adventure books. I loved those things, so I did read a lot of those.
Well, what was the transformation from, do you think that then, based on what you said, you said you don't follow formula, you're not much of a reader, that when you're writing the story comes in your head and you're literally seeing it as a movie. So do you think you're really writing movies?
I think I am in a way. I really do. I think that I kind of write movies.
You're not writing them in script fashion, but that's
right, because I have no idea how to write a script. But honestly, yeah, I think because a lot of people, my books write themselves. All my fingers do is type them out. A lot of people tell me, in fact, that's why my books are so popular, is because when I write a book, you feel like you're watching it. People have said you don't read my works, you live them. So, yeah, I guess I could be writing a movie because I can't stand. I have read everything from your nobody author that no one's ever heard of to your New York Times bestseller, and I have read everything from just total crap to books that were fabulous, and I have found that the books I cannot read are the ones that I cannot identify with. I have to be able to read a book and see it in my head as I'm reading it. So that's why I write the way I do.
So of the books that you've read that you think are ones that you could identify with or as, you know, you would say with air quotes, good, what would those be?
You know, and that's really sad because I cannot remember the names of these books, but they were mystery books. Read them, gosh, probably 12 years ago. And I wish I could remember the names of them because I've got them somewhere out in my garage, I think, packed away in a box. They were fabulous. They were mystery books, and I could see pretty much everything that was going on with them while I was reading them. But they were mystery, and they took place in a bed and breakfast in, like, upstate New York. Nothing horror, nothing scary. They were typical, almost like an Agatha Christie style mystery, I guess.
And are your books mostly set in present day then?
Yes, they're all set in present day, but I have a penchant for time travel and reflecting back on things that happened in the past. So when you read my books, there will be a lot of reflection on with like the zombies because they're immortal. In Left to the Night Alone, there's a lot of reflection because the woman in that is an immortal. In A Man of Two Worlds, there's a lot of reflection because you've got four vampires, you've got four zombies, and they've all lived basically forever. So even though my books take place in the present, they've been referred to as fractal fantasies because I do a lot of remembering back when. And then I'll tell like a whole story or I'll tell like a whole thing of what happened in the past.
So I'm trying to think here of something that would be comparable to that, but I mean, other than flashbacks, I guess there's really nothing else.
Well, that's kind
said.
Of what they are. They're kind of flashbacks. That's what I refer to them as.
But so you're not really doing like historical research or anything?
No, I mean, well, I did for A Man of Two Worlds because I did do a lot of flashbacks in that, and I had to make sure that, like, in one part of the book, one of the characters is from, I believe I made him from Bulgaria, in the area of Bulgaria that I made him from. The actual country of Bulgaria was not called Bulgaria then. Can't remember what the name of it was, but it had a different name, and I actually had to go on the internet and check the date and make sure that the name of the area, territory, whatever they called it at that time, coincided with the actual date.
Yeah. So you do some fact-checking, but I mean, you're
immersed
in a time period or something like that.
Oh, no, because I don't want my readers to feel like they're reading a school manual.
So
I make sure that no one can come behind my books and say, okay, this is not historically accurate. I make sure that my books are historically accurate, but I don't want someone to feel like that they're in school.
So now you said that you and your husband caretake at a cemetery. Do you ever get any ideas from the tombstones, character names, or fantasies built on, you know, you see dates or...
No, we're out there strictly to work. To fix broken gravestones and take away old flowers and put new ones out and things like that. It's strictly work for us.
Because when I go to cemeteries, I'm always, you know, little vignettes or possibilities, you know, especially when you see, you know, a family and you see everybody wiped out by, cholera or something or polio or whatever, you know, based on the dates, you go, wow, that epidemic swept through this family and only one person lived or that kind of thing.
Right. Well, I do. I do look at the cemeteries like that, and I do wonder what happened to families. I also collect memento mori, which is photography of dead people. And I love cemeteries because they're historical. I have a real love of history. But I don't go there to get ideas. I go there simply to work. My ideas form in my mind all by themselves. But for cemeteries, I just love to go there and look at the history of what happened. Like you said, an entire family being wiped out. Like if I look at a certain area and there's 10 graves from 1885 all within a few months of each other, I think, okay, there must have been an epidemic that came through here then.
Yeah, my brain can't help but you know, do math and numbers and imagine, you know, what that must be like, funerals every other week, you know, until you're right. only, you know, there'd be only one person left who lives another 40 years, and you go, wow, they, you know.
Right. Oh, no, my brain constantly does that in any cemetery I go to, but it doesn't give me ideas for stories. I go out there to enjoy the history and the heritage.
Well, I'm going to ask you, as we wrap up here, to because I usually do post-show notes so that anyone listening to the show can come to cultofgracie.com and get the URL for things we talk about. Your MySpace page, is the name for that is?
It is myspace.com/gothicscribe, and scribe is S-C-R-Y-B-E.
Ah. And from there, and you have a really long website name. It's Forgotten, Lost, and Damned or something like that?
The Lost, the Forgotten, the Damned.com.
Yeah, all those does. And from there, we'll be able to find the magazines?
Yes. If you go to my profile on MySpace, Twisted Dreams is, I believe it's the second over in my top friends.
Okay. And the other one? No, is that the poetry one or is that the...
Well, Twisted Dreams is the mother magazine to them both. Twisted Dreams is the one that I do a little bit of everything in that. But the guidelines for Worlds Within, Worlds Beyond, which is the dark poetry magazine, they're also on that same page.
Okay. I just want people to be able to find out and find out more.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's Michael, and then you said there was a new book that's going to be out on the 28th?
Right. That is The Legacy, The Grounds of Nakmashihin, which is my first ever mainstream work. It's a pirate thriller.
And that is published by?
That is published by Triad Publishing.
Triad Publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And people can stay up to date with you and your news at MySpace. That's where you do your blogging?
Right. That's where I do my blogging. They can keep up with me there.
Okay. And you have any newsletters or anything?
Nearly every day.
And you have a newsletter or anything at your website or anything that they need to sign up for there or the blog?
Well,
is the
they can go to my website and they can sign up, and anytime I do any updates to my website, they'll get a note. I don't do a newsletter because I figure if people subscribe to my blog, I'd put more information in that than I ever would in a newsletter. And people tend to ignore newsletters. I like to give people a choice. If they want to read what I've got in my blog, they can, but there's nothing I hate any worse than being inundated with a newsletter.
I need things to come to me sometimes, but then it's usually scheduled. But you're right, a lot of them don't get opened. Well, I appreciate you coming here and sticking out with me an extra half an hour or so. And
no problem. Thanks for having me. I've had a good time.
Yeah, and I'm glad I got to help clean your pantry.
Yeah, you got to help me as my little Beneful containers fell all over the floor.
Oh, well, that's just because we're a couple of B-words, right? We needed to be fed.
That's true.
Well, thanks a lot, Andrea. I appreciate it. And I wish everybody who's still listening or who has been to the is downloaded and listening now, thanks for listening to Cult of Gracie Radio. And stay tuned for next week. You can always catch up at the blog, cultofgracie.com, or you can just go to xxbn.net and you'll see the latest shows listed there as well. Thanks a lot and good night.
Thank you, Gracie. Good night.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.